Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, it is time for the toy department. A day late this week, and that is my fault, Matt Kolsky.
Yeah, it is. It is your fault. I thought you were going to elaborate. That's why I didn't jump right in there.
No,
fair enough.
It's my bad. Right. I'm a busy man.
You are a busy and important individual, and I would never suggest otherwise.
I got Zoom calls to masturbate on. I got all sorts of stuff going on.
This is definitely not the toy department, but a brief aside.
I mean, it kind of is.
I just want to ask you one question. No.
Yeah.
I feel like possibly we need to cut this entire segment after. I don't even know.
I agree. I think maybe it's best for all. But if you have any more questions, I'm happy to answer those.
No, I'm going to cut back in right at the spot where I just said we should cut that whole segment. But just people need to understand that a Jeffrey Toobin conversation is truly not in the toy department and leads you to a weird place. So let's talk about TV and stuff.
Toobin is going to be a great verb, I feel like, going forward.
Oh, never go full Toobin. Okay. I heard someone go with the Jeffrey Toobin took his tube out on a Zoom call. Anyway. All right.
Yep. Yes,
movies,
indeed.
TV, what do you think?
Movies, TV. Yeah. All right. Let's jump into the homework from last week. Where would you like to start? Because we can really start anywhere this weekend.
Let's do the thing you didn't do last week that you were supposed to do, but hopefully now you've done, which is watch the Comedy Store docuseries. I believe 3 episodes are out so far.
I didn't do it.
That's not funny.
Yeah. All right. Sorry. I'm kidding. I watched all 3. Mike Binder. Is it Binder or Binder? I always get that wrong.
I think it's Binder, but I can't remember.
His version of the Comedy Store documentary. Here's where I am on this. Like, I had a good time watching this. You know, we're somewhat comedy nerds, I would say. I feel like we qualify as comedy nerds.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, it was, but I think a lot of that is just, there were a lot of funny people, you know, who worked at the Comedy Store, and watching clips of Richard Pryor do stand up and stuff is cool. I don't 100% know. I can't tell if this is trying to tell the story of the Comedy Store or kind of really just the story of comedy. You know what I mean? But there are a lot of times where it doesn't really seem to be all that much about the store. Does that make sense?
In fact, this is what I have written down. I think this documentary is attempting to tell the story of comedy sort of vis-a-vis the Comedy Store, whilst making the argument that the Comedy Store is at the heart of comedy in a deep sort of spiritual way.
Yeah, and I think it's more like, at least the impression that I get is like the Comedy Store is at the heart of comedy in the sense that like it was definitely a big comedy center in the biggest entertainment city in America. But like, is it more, you know, the heart of comedy than the Cellar, you know, in New York, right? Which I'm sure could also tell a similar story with a bunch of equally famous comics.
But don't you think that's kind of it?
You know what I mean?
But isn't that, aren't those the two? I mean, I think you're right, but I think those are the two. There's comedy in New York, there's comedy in L.A., and those are the clubs. Not that there aren't others that are perfectly good, but those are where you sort of had to earn your stripes.
Well, but there are, like, I mean, like in New York, you could talk about Caroline's, or you could, right? And in L.A., there are a bunch of other clubs, right? And they're, you know, I would also throw over, right, Chicago has a huge comedy scene that a lot of famous people have gone through. Like,
but that's not comedy clubs. That's Second City. So really, it really is, yeah, and there's Groundlings in L.A. There's other things. But if you are like, there's something about those two clubs, the Cellar in New York and the Store in L.A., that it feels like all the really great ones went through there. And that excludes some incredibly well-earning, you know, well-liked comedians. But, like, there's a credibility to those particular two clubs more than Caroline's or the Improv in L.A. or, you know, the Laugh Factory, whatever it is.
There's three or four of them in L.A., honestly, that are you know, famous,
I don't know, man.
Comedy clubs.
They're famous, but I feel like the Store is a different thing.
Maybe. And look, it's not like the show doesn't at times go through that. You know what I mean?
It certainly makes that argument.
Yeah. I just don't know that it's – that's, I guess, what I'm saying. Is like, I don't know if it's entirely convincing in that part of it. You know what I mean? Like, I get there are a lot of famous comics who love and cherish the Store. A lot of them. Some of them really famous. You know what I mean? But I think a lot of that is just like, hey, whatever the biggest comedy club in LA is going to sort of be like that. And then they're also not talking to the people who are like, fuck that place.
I think they will, though, because I think we get into sort of the dark days of that club, maybe. And I think the 80s and 90s in particular, it's like not great.
Yeah. Yeah. I just feel like, I don't know. Like, I feel like you could make a documentary about a comedy club in Boston whose name I don't know. And I feel like a lot of the comics would all know it and all have stories about it.
Not
you know
like
what
this,
I mean?
Though. I don't think, no, because of Mitzi and because of just the sort
right,
of
because
dark...
a bunch of these comics lived in LA, so they hung out there all the time. You know what I mean?
Well, but I mean, that's part of it. That's why New York and LA have the biggest comedy scenes is because that's where the entertainment industry lives. You know, I mean, but there's no way a documentary about, like, you know, whatever club in Boston would be anything like this. I think you're underestimating the gravity and the sort of, again, the almost like spiritual reverence for this place throughout the comedy community, especially among like a certain respected class of comedians who I think you and I both feel like are better than most, you know?
That I would agree. I mean, I think we also like, or at least I like, a lot of the comics that kind of, you know, came more from the, like, UCB sort of wanted to sidestep some of this kind of stuff, comedy, but...
Yeah, but that's not stand-up, you know? So, like, that's... I really see that as a different thing. Those people are funny, and most of them are actors and actresses who are excellent, but it's not the same as a stand-up club.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say some of them are stand-up, but like, is Nick Kroll a stand-up? You know,
no.
Like Paul Scheer or Aziz Ansari?
Aziz,
like, they're not stand-up?
Aziz is. The only guy who I would consider really a stand-up that you just mentioned is Aziz. And,
you know,
and even Aziz, I think, is a better actor than he is a stand-up, fundamentally.
Yeah, maybe. That might be true. All right, you know, I'm a little bit curious because I do also feel like we watched – you know, kind of a TV show that was essentially a fictionalized version of this.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guys from that show was actually in this.
Andrew
doing stand-up.
Santino. Yeah. I think he's the only guy on that show who's actually a stand-up.
Is that true?
One of the only, anyway.
You might be right, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Yeah. How did you like, I felt a lot of echoes of that show in this thing.
Yeah. I mean, that show is very clearly based specifically on the Comedy Store.
I mean,
so yeah. Yeah, there were a lot of similarities.
It kind of makes me feel like the show should have been better. What was the name of the show? I never remember the name of the show.
I'm dying up here. I like the show.
I did too. I like the show too. Yeah. But I feel like maybe, you know, I don't know. Could have used a Sam Kinison character. That's for sure.
I expect a Sam Kinison character was coming. But you know, Sam Kinison is sort of the guy who ruins everything.
yeah, exactly.
So that was probably like season 3 or 4. I don't know.
Yeah, look, I mean, look, if you're thinking about should I watch this, like, it's a delight to watch Mark Maron and Bill Burr and Whitney Cummings tell stories, you know what I mean? Like, sure. Right.
And the older stuff, too. I mean, I didn't know much about Freddie Prinze, you know?
Yeah, I knew a little bit.
Yeah, me too. I knew the basic outline of the story, but, like, I don't think I'd ever seen any Chico and the Man or any Freddie Prinze stand-up.
Yeah, and there's some great, like, old Tonight Show stuff, you know what I mean? Or, like, in the last episode, like, seeing Stephen Wright's first Tonight Show appearance when he was 26 was, Stephen like, Wright. You know. And that was pretty cool.
And, look, I mean, I think there's something to that as well. Like, I don't know where original bizarre voices like Stephen Wright might have gotten that opportunity, if not for Mitzi Shore and her, like, weird taste. Like, that woman curated the national comedy scene, essentially, for years because of her connection to Johnny Carson.
Yeah, it was. I think that was interesting to me, too, to, like, just, you know, and you think about, like, the depth of sort of 80s comedy, or, like, seeing somebody like Kathy Ladman, who's, like, not a person you'd ever, like, name, but when you see that, you're like, oh, yeah, I remember seeing her around all the time, or, like, you know, I think Elaine Boozler maybe has like a little bit better rep, but like, you know, or the like Tim Thomason or like you
Tim
Thomason, like some of the,
yes,
yeah,
insane,
like the depth guys in like 80s comedy. You're like, oh, there was so much of this funny stuff that was on my TV or, you know, on, I think it was called the Comedy Channel at the time, right? It was like pre Comedy Central where you'd see these like stand ups and stuff, you know, that there was this really vibrant scene and that she was at the heart of it, you know? And then there's of course the whole Pauly Shore aspect, which I kind of hope they get more into, to be honest. Like, I want to hear a little bit more about where Pauly was in all this. So.
Yeah. It sounds like he was just hanging out. That's like a 10-year-old. No wonder he's so weird. Right. I mean, it really is insight into Pauly Shore who, by the way, seems like a really sweet man.
Yeah, sure does.
Yeah.
I imagine saw some deeply fucked up things.
Yeah, man.
At a tender age.
Yeah.
So, you know, worth a watch, Comedy Store.
I think so. And it's interesting just to see all these bizarre people who have such a strange affection for this crazy place.
Yes. I don't know if it feels like a strange affection. It seems like they spent a lot of time there.
Sure.
A lot of them spent a lot of time trying to be the person who can spend a lot of time there, right? Like, they'd take some effort to be that, you know.
Maybe not
I mean?
Strange, so. just very particular and extensive.
Yeah. Highly specific.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Trial of the Chicago 7.
Indeed.
I'm very curious as to what you thought about this, because I don't feel like I 100% know where you stand on Aaron Sorkin.
It's funny you say that. I watched it with my wife, and the moment it ended, boom, she said, she goes, God, that was very talky. And I was like, yeah. You know, it's Aaron Sorkin. And she was like, yeah, I know, but still. And I actually, by Aaron Sorkin standards, and I don't know if it was just that I enjoyed the performances or I, you know, was thinking more about how the subject matter was disturbingly relevant. I didn't find it unnecessarily talky, as Aaron Sorkin can sometimes feel.
I was going to say, I thought it was the least, one of the least Sorkin-y Sorkin things, you know.
Agreed.
You know what I mean? Like,
okay.
Like,
yeah.
The rat-a-tat back and forth, you know, hyper literate, you know, I'm going to throw a little joke at you.
Yeah.
like that kind of banter. There wasn't that much of that, right? Like,
well, no, I mean, to the extent that it existed, it was mostly Sacha Baron Cohen and Eddie Redmayne, and it felt true right. to their characters.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm with you. I mean, it was a talky movie, but it didn't feel oppressively talky, I think, because it was a talky subject matter and a talky time in history. So, and a bunch of talky people, you know?
Yes. Yes.
And like this could have been like the Aaron Sorkiniest version of this. Those two dudes who really like weren't involved would have a bunch of quippy, like interstitial lines, you know?
Right.
They would be like jumping in to say stuff all the time. They would just be constant barrage. You know what I'm saying? And it didn't feel like that to me.
It felt like those two guys mostly existed for Abby Hoffman to drop that one line on them, you know,
and for
the
them,
the movie.
Yeah. And for them to keep being like, what are we doing here? So that when Abby Hoffman drops the line, you're like, ah, I see.
Yeah.
And
light bulb.
Yeah. I thought it was really good. Really good.
Yeah. I enjoyed it quite a bit. You know, you mentioned, performances. I mean, obviously, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen's doing a lot of heavy lifting, in this and he's excellent. And Eddie Redmayne's excellent. I really loved, it's a bit of a lesser part, but like Jeremy Strong's full commitment.
Phenomenal.
Was
phenomenal.
Tremendous.
You tremendous. Like, you know, I did recognize him, but I feel like someone who wasn't, you know, super familiar could go the whole movie without knowing it was him. He's just, especially if all you've seen him in is Succession, he's just totally immersed in this ridiculous hippie character.
Yeah. And to think that you're kind of pairing up Sacha Baron Cohen and Jeremy Strong, and you're like, let's make Sacha the straight man and Strong the funny guy. And it completely works, you know? I mean, I guess, you know, Sacha obviously is not a totally straight role, but
yeah.
Of the two, he's sort of like the grounded one, you know what I mean?
In a way, yeah. I mean, neither of them are really the straight man, but they're both just excellent. And Eddie Redmayne is excellent. You know, I that's a complicated part. I thought the guy who plays the lawyer, whose name I don't know, was awesome.
Yeah. The guy who played the assistant lawyer is kind of playing the same part that he plays in a million things, but he's
right.
really good at that too.
Uh-huh. The judge, I mean, Joseph Gordon-Levitt was spectacular, I thought, in this movie. There was a just a really, and God, I can't remember anyone's name now. From the Dr. Manhattan from the Watchmen TV show.
His name's really hard to say.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he plays Bobby Seale, and I thought he was excellent.
Yeah,
Abdul-Mateen, is that?
Yeah, I believe that's right. I think that's right.
Yeah, he's great. And I, you know, look, again, I vaguely knew the story of the Chicago 7. Like, it's a fairly well-known thing, but there was stuff I did not know. And like most of the Bobby Seale story. And just, you know, it really is shockingly relevant.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think, and this is something that, you know, you could easily see Sorkin be tempted to do. I don't think this beats you over the head with, hey, this could also be looked at as an allegory about modern times.
No,
you know what I mean?
No, that's my brain did that work. This is, really is a historical document in a way.
Yep. You know, it's just sort of, I think that everything that they were thinking about was pretty true to them in that specific moment in their lives. And, you know, it sort of leaves you to draw the parallels as to what's happening now. I mean, I guess you could argue that maybe some of the scenes of the FBI when they sort of decide to go after these guys have a, you know, had sort of an obvious historical analog, but they're, you know, that's really early in the film. So
yeah, and again, that's just, I mean, that's the story. It's the ridiculous story of what actually happened here. There's no political trials. You know, that like that's the political trial, fake news. You know what I'm saying? It's
Sure did. So you know, I'm glad Sorkin's here, and I like when he's doing this, and as opposed to like the newsroom.
Personally. Agreed. I didn't bother with the newsroom. This is very interesting to me, so I'm with you on that 100%. Strong recommend for the Trial of the Chicago 7 on Netflix. Right. I want to now switch from subject matter wise to the
Can I just ask really quick? Does that make you any more excited for throwing West Wing into homework? The fact that you like this?
Sure.
Okay.
I want to switch to the least related, least weighty subject matter now, if that's okay.
Okay. Sure.
I, like you, despite your insistence that I need not watch the entirety of Ted Lasso in like 2 to 2.5 days over the course of the last week. And all I can say about this show, for those who don't know, and I did not know this. Did you know it's based on an SNL character?
It's not, I don't think.
What?
I believe that what it is
or
based
on. Or a commercial.
On,
a commercial, sorry.
Yeah, exactly. It's characters from commercials for when NBC first got the Premier League.
Right.
He was a character that they had commercials as a former football coach who, you know, was getting into football.
That's my bad. I was thinking SNL commercial because it's Jason Sudeikis, but it's just an actual commercial. I didn't know that. But like you said, it's just like a rah-rah successful, you know, what is it, championship subdivision head football coach.
Wichita State, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. He's a Shocker. Yes. And he gets hired to coach a Premier League team in like a major league scenario. But the hook is he's – of the show, and I don't remember the commercials, so I don't know if this was really part of it, but the hook of the show is he's just so relentlessly optimistic and delightful that even people who want to hate him come to love him because he's lovable. And what?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is you sort of hit on the key thing because it was not part of the original commercials were kind of just American, you know, American guy doesn't get football.
Right.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
so this guy, though,
the decision that, but I do think that decision to sort of make it this guy who like still doesn't get football really, you know, soccer,
right.
But understands people and team
and knows
family,
what he doesn't know.
Yes. Yeah. Like the decision to make that, it really makes this show almost, you know what I mean?
Yes, because the show is the guy. I mean, the show is called The Guy, but it is the guy. It's cheesy and ridiculous and stupid, and it is so unbelievably irresistible that none of that matters because it's just wonderful. Like, you laugh at the cheesy jokes because it's wonderful. In the same way that the characters laugh at him and his stupid jokes, because he's wonderful. Like, you can't help it. This show is... this is, like, some of the best TV crack I've had in a long time.
Yep. Yeah, like, when those guys... when, like, the four of them are sitting around in the locker room and they kind of become the Diamond Dogs, right?
The Diamond Dogs! Amazing!
It's like it's such a great scene, you know. And I do think that all of the secondary characters, the players and the clubhouse people, and you know, everyone is really wonderfully drawn.
Juno,
you know what
Temple
I mean?
Is a just a dream. She's phenomenal. The assistant, like the GM character. Is so funny.
Higgins?
Yes, yeah. Higgins. I mean, the assistant coach, Nate the Great, There's so much. This show has heart. It's hilarious. It's unbelievably, irresistibly charming. I can't say enough good things about it, truly. It's the platonic ideal of a situation comedy.
Yeah, it's really great. And I, you know, I mean, so Bill Lawrence, right, is the guy that executive produced that. And I do feel like if you like Scrubs.
Yes.
Or Cougar Town, even. I think, like, a lot of that vibe, that sort of warm, happy family sort of vibe is really mixed in with that. And outside of Michael Schur, I don't know if there's anyone who does that vibe as well as Bill Lawrence does.
That's the level this is on. If you love Scrubs, like The Good Place, like that's the level this is on to me. It's not quite as philosophically weighty as The Good Place, but it just in terms of a comedy with heart, it is fantastic. Really, really, truly fantastic. Worth the price of Apple TV Plus, I would say.
There you go. Wow. All right. Did you buy Apple TV Plus?
More or less.
Okay. I know. Now I'm like, I guess I got to go back and watch The Morning Show and see if that's a thing.
No. I don't think we're gonna do that. Calm down. Calm down, please. I mean, all
I'm
due
so
respect.
I'm so glad that you loved it, but I'm also not surprised. You know what I mean? Like, you could, you know, like I said, I watched it all in one sitting. That's how crackleg it is. Like, you can just roll from one to the next, you know?
It's hard
and
not
they've
to.
Already renewed it, which is great, but I can't wait for more. You know what I mean?
I can't believe it's going to be a long time, and that makes me sad.
Yeah, it does seem like it would be a real tough show to make under pandemic circumstances, unfortunately.
Yeah, true story.
Yeah, bummer. all right. What else do we have on this list? Hold on.
Well, we have the David Byrne piece / Spike
Lee. Yeah, American Utopia. Mm-hmm. The thing that confused the hell out of me because I didn't realize it was the David Byrne thing.
Right.
We were doing homework.
Yes. That's right. That's the thing.
Which is really poor by me because I, you know, and David kind of alludes to it at some point during the show, but like I have seen this show as a rock tour.
You saw it
more than once.
More than once.
Yeah. Yes. So I haven't seen.
Was
know,
it
I did
called
not see
American
Broadway.
Utopia at the time?
It was not. No, that. Okay. Although I think I want to say the album might have been American Utopia that they were touring on.
Okay.
I need to look that up. But I didn't see the Broadway version, which obviously has a little bit more kind of some of these talk interstitials. But the musical performances are pretty much the same. Like they all had that sort of level of choreography
and marching
that
band
staging,
thing.
You know, yeah. And marching band sort of deal in which I think he explains really well, in terms of, you know, wanting to have people on the stage, but really minimize the things around them. And you see almost no wires or anything like that. Right. It's all, people, instruments, and headset mics is basically the whole deal, right?
Yeah. So. Well, I guess, this was good. I liked it. I love David Byrne. I really like the Talking Heads. I really like his whole old man aesthetic. I just mean that in terms of like the way he has aged and the things he has chosen to do. He's deeply artistic. He makes me think about things. I love David Byrne. And this is really good. And I think the what's the word I'm looking for? Target audience, I guess, is anyone who would have liked to see this Broadway or touring show, but either didn't have the money or missed it when it was in town.
Yeah,
I'm not sure this is for anybody else.
I would agree with that. I would say. As a film, as a concert film, you know what I mean? Even though it's Spike Lee directing, who obviously is a master and is great.
Yeah.
I don't know how much the filming of it added to it. You know what I mean? Like, I would recommend
you don't feel like it. You don't feel like it took away from it, though, do you?
No. I feel like it was just basically like, I feel like anybody could have directed it. It's kind of, I guess is maybe what I'm saying. You know what I
mean?
Yeah, like,
in a way. I mean, I would guess Spike probably did it as professionally and successfully as anybody. And
yeah,
but it's not like
mean that as a criticism of Spike.
No, I know. Just, but I was going to say
no frills direction, concert direction is what I would say.
Right. It's not saying. A Spike yeah. Lee joint. It's a concert film that happens to have been handled by a master.
Correct. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And that's fine. And again, like, I, if anything, I bet it enhanced it a little just from the perspective of someone who hasn't seen it in terms of, like, I really felt like I was in it, you know, watching it in a dark room by myself. I was in there. It was really cool. Yeah. And I think that's a good job. You know, it's a good job by Spike Lee. It's not a like groundbreaking job or a wow job, but it's a good job. And it was a good.
Did you watch much of the credits?
Remind me.
So, like, at the end, you see...
the biking?
Them sort of
I watched
biking
the credits.
To the show.
Yeah.
I wish there was a little bit more of that. You know what I mean?
Like city that scenes. Kind
of
thing. Uh-huh.
Like, yeah, scenes of just them, not you know, not just doing the show, getting ready, seeing, like, what goes into that. You know what I mean? Like, obviously, the fact that they all bike to work together
it's
was
cute.
A choice.
Yeah, it's very cute. You know what I mean? And it should be said, as I can't believe we made it this far without saying, the musicianship overall, tremendous. Some of those people, like the Brazilian drum section, holy Moses, they're awesome.
Yeah.
The lady who's like a ballerina and a crazy drummer and can sing her ass off, like, wow.
Yeah, just the man and the woman that he has singing behind him, who I think have been with him now for a while, are tremendous. Everyone has these sort of Broadway caliber voices, and the dance moves are fantastic. It's an ace band.
And David Byrne is such a unique and bizarre and funny physical presence, and he's an old man. He truly understands how his bizarre movements and hit frame and like tics are affecting the performance. You know what I mean? Like he's just, or maybe it's just that everything is built around his bizarre movements and tics and whatnot. And it's just, there's a seamlessness to the whole production that is quite impressive, especially since he's sort of just, like, those chats don't feel like a Broadway show. They feel like David Byrne pausing the show and breaking the fourth wall, right? I mean, that's what's happening.
Yeah, they do. I agree with that. And, seamless is a good word because I think the other thing that he's doing here, right, is, like, you see so many stars of classic rock who are kind of imprisoned by the classic records that they made. And
yes.
I think that you know, this tour, these sets, and I would say many other, because I've seen David Byrne a few times now, he is able to sort of seamlessly understand, like, okay, yes, there are certain songs that people want from me, and there are certain things that I want to do, and there are new things that I am interested in, and I can take them all and blend them together and give people what they want, but also give people things that I want and make it all equally as compelling. You know, like,
yeah.
I mean, look, obviously, there's a certain thrill when he's doing a Talking Head song that you love. But,
yeah.
Like,
there's
all
also
of the new stuff is great. And there are David Byrne solo songs that I have come to love just from seeing him play them live enough times, you know?
Yeah. And there are also, there's also a thrill when he talks about Janelle Monáe and then covers that song. You know, like,
yeah.
This is, it's a. And that's what I mean when I say I love David Byrne is, like, he's just a thoughtful, interesting man. And, like, here's to more creative stuff from thoughtful, interesting people.
Yeah. You know, especially people who are, you know, on decade five or six.
Yeah.
Thoughtful and interesting.
That's right. And I think maybe, you know, like, I don't know that David Byrne has quite the populist appeal of a Bowie figure, but, like, that's sort of the space he occupies to me, is, like, a musical genius who's also a deeply caring person and like a cultural icon and still producing creative, interesting stuff in his 70s, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know what I mean? I don't know how many, you know, stars of classic rock could credibly make a record with St. Vincent. You know what I mean?
Right. So, or would seek out St. Vincent, yeah, and have heard her and be interested and curious. He's, well, what he is he's a true artist. Like David Byrne's soul is art. So like he's curious about it and he's looking for it and listening to it. And that's what I think has led him to have instead of being in a Talking Heads reunion tour, he's on stage with a Brazilian drum section marching band to, professional dance singers, an incredible bassist and guitarist, shout out the bassist from Chicago, and just like telling stories and jamming out. You know, the guy is fascinating, and I love him.
Yeah, yeah. And this was a nice showcase for him. Like I said, you know, I'm still on. Just go see this show if you get an opportunity. But if you don't, this is an excellent substitute for that. And obviously,
yeah,
ain't going to be any shows anywhere for a while. So
yeah, indeed.
So why not? All right, I think homework wise, right? That leaves us with.
Hold on. Okay. Yeah, I thought you were. I thought you were going to get us into homework, and I was like, "No, sir. No. There's another thing."
No. So indeed, the last item for discussion is Lovecraft Country, and for me, you know, there's the obvious analog. I feel like for the show or point of comparison is Watchmen from early in the summer, right? You know, you got a show that airs on HBO. They're in the Bad Robot family. You know, they're both specifically concerned with the Tulsa riots at times. And much like that show, Lovecraft Country was a show where, especially in the early episodes, I watched a lot of them twice, really just to try to understand what the hell was happening, which I think is kind of where we left it when we were last discussing it. Like, this is really interesting. I don't always know what's going on.
100%.
And I feel like, unlike Watchmen, which by the time it resolves, you're like, oh, I get this, and the ride was totally worth it. By the time I got to the end of Lovecraft, I feel like I felt like, oh, this show is just mostly interested in things that I'm not all that interested in. You know, and particularly in this last episode, which was about sort of tying story threads together and kind of dealing with the machinations of the plot. Like, I don't care about magic and I don't care about spells. And it just was wholly uninteresting to me.
Well,
I loved this show when it was talking about people and, you know, why someone might want to be white for a day or what it was like to sort of deal with those times. Or even the relationships between the various characters, you know, the Tick's, you know, family issues or the romance between him and Letty. Like, all of that stuff was great. And I think it was really well made. But, like, at the end of the day, this show is just interested in things that, for me, are just not very interesting.
Well, yeah, see, and obviously I think this is well-trod ground for us as a show. Like, that stuff, generally speaking, is interesting to me. But as you kind of just pointed out, that's not what this show was about at any point until it came time to wrap things up. And then it was like, oh, you know, all that magic stuff that's sort of been like going on the side almost. That's what we're actually talking about.
Yeah. And I think it built towards that. I mean, you know, like, well, like if you don't care extent, about the Book of Names, you know what I mean? Like the last couple episodes where they're on the hunt for it, you know what I mean?
Right. But if like the Book of Names, I don't know, like it, I feel like the suggestion all along was that we're going to get to a point where like this resolves and it's going to be about the themes that have permeated throughout. And it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was just about magic. And like, I guess it was just, it felt like the finale of a less serious show, right?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, like the scene at the end with Dee and I don't even know her name, but the blonde girl, you know,
Christina.
Yeah. Like, did that have any emotional resonance for you at all?
Not really.
Yeah, no, me neither. And I feel like that was supposed to be, you know, if it was a movie, that was supposed to be the moment where everybody claps, right? You know, because the big bad goes down. And I was kind of like, eh, all right, you know.
Yeah.
I guess she got what's coming to her.
Right. Right.
So, and I'm not trying to bury the show as unsuccessful because it's incredibly well made and wildly interesting at times, and yeah. I think really ambitious, and there's a lot to like about it.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
I'd watch another season of it, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I assume they're going to do another one. You know, it's interesting. I was looking at the ratings. I mean, they're only averaging like 700,000 people an episode per Wikipedia.
Yeah. That stuff's so weird, though. Who knows how they make their choices? I mean, I don't know. But I do think this, first of all, that's still pretty good for non-sports, non-live programming.
Right. And obviously, HBO, there's a million airings, and I'm sure the totals look different. But it also looks super-duper expensive, right, to make.
So. Right. But there's streaming stuff, too, and I bet a ton of people are watching it on streaming. So, you know, sometimes, well, who knows if what the financial incentive are. It definitely sets itself up for a second season, right?
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, and again, like, it seemed more about magic and setting itself up for a second season than, you know, delivering something plot-wise that tied it into the themes that it explored throughout the season, which was really the best part of it. But that's, you know, not the end of the world. Like, I think there's still a ton of emotional resonance to the ride we took with Lovecraft Country, and I don't regret it.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, just because I didn't enjoy the destination doesn't mean I didn't enjoy the journey, you know?
100%. I think we're very much on the same page on that.
Yeah. So, and you're right, I would watch another season. Yeah. Although I don't know if I will spend next season watching episodes twice, you know?
Right, right. That makes sense.
So yeah, I'm good with that. All right, anything in sports you want to talk about before we get to homework?
I don't know, man. The NFL's nobody's that good, and I know you don't want to talk World Series, so
it's true. I'm a little bit curious because when the question that we've asked a couple of times over the course of the season is who is the third best team in the AFC, and I still think that's maybe the most interesting question in football right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a two team list right now for that spot, and interestingly enough, it's two teams that are, you know, should have played each other but didn't because of the virus. I think the Steelers and Titans are probably the two teams that have the best argument.
Yeah, they're playing each other this week, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I think that's right. They're both undefeated. They both have, you know, players who make you believe they could really be good. They're both well coached. It's interesting. But, you know, I think the bigger story is even Kansas City is not great, perhaps, which means there really are no great teams.
Yeah, that is. I think this is a year. Honestly, it would be weird if there was a great team. I feel like almost, you know,
maybe
just because teams. There's no training camp. Teams weren't practicing. You know, and then there's an incredible amount of injuries to key players. And
but
then
that's COVID, yeah. But that's kind of why Kansas City felt like the team that could be great. They haven't had too many injuries yet. They're pretty much the same team they were last year when they were the best team in football all year long for the most part. And they came out like gangbusters. But even they have looked vulnerable more than once. So
yeah, no, they clearly don't seem to be quite the team that they were last year. And no. I think that team may still be in them, but it's not quite there right now. No. I would agree with that.
No, and then
although you still favor them, right, over yes, anybody else at this point.
I do, but it's closer. I'm not as convinced, and there's just so much that can happen, and there's already been so much that has happened that I don't even know what we know about anything. So I think that's more than enough NFL, to be totally honest with you.
I'm totally fair with that. Totally fair with that.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I did want to sing the praises of Mike Vrabel for half a second while we're talking about Tennessee, because, like, that dude is pulling off these, like, showy coaching moves.
Yes.
You know, that I'm, like, you know, I didn't realize this is the second time where he'd taken an intentional 12-man on the field penalty and gained, like, 2 minutes worth of advantage, and you throw in like the punt thing from the playoffs like last year. Like,
yep.
Crafty Mike Vrabel, I really enjoy.
It's pretty incredible because it's just not what you expected. Like a former linebacker turned head coach being sort of a like time clock management genius. It's
a rules expert. Yeah. Like,
yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. Wild. And also, yeah, he seems to be coaching up a hell of a football team. You know, I mean, they're doing different stuff from most of the league, and they're succeeding with it for going on 2 years now. So, you know, he deserves a ton of credit.
Yeah, and I don't always know that he's really getting it, to be honest. So
I think he's starting to.
Yeah, I think maybe it's starting to happen. But, you know, when your own team as a coach can't get out of his own way
– Well, he's out of the way now, isn't he?
Yep. Well, yes. He didn't get himself out of the way, though.
He got right out of the way.
So, indeed. All right. Well, sports are sad for me, so we can move on to homework if you want.
Yep.
All right. So, Bill Murray's back. You know, that's exciting times. We're going to watch On the Rocks.
Back with Sofia Coppola.
Yeah.
And
like Phoenix songs on the soundtrack. And, yeah, I'm
feels,
into it.
Feels like home.
And then neither one of us knows all that much about The Undoing other than Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant, right?
Yeah, that's about it's about the extent of it.
And somebody's in court. I know that. That's pretty much all I got for you there. But we're going to check that out. There's also a Netflix miniseries called The Queen's Gambit about a female chess prodigy in 60s Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And as we sort of alluded to earlier, you know, now that we got a little Sorkin out of the way, we're going to try the West Wing reunion special on HBO Max. Now, this is interesting because Kolsky is somewhat, at least, famous on this show, not West Wing watcher. So,
yeah, but I'm not like angry at the West Wing. It's just I didn't watch it at the time, and it's a large project to take on, so I haven't done it. But
yeah, you know, I did run into like an old episode the other day on TNT, and it really, I found it to be tremendous comfort food. You know, like
I'm happy.
It felt nice.
I'm glad you're finding ways to make yourself feel good. I support you.
Yeah, you know, like imagine a world with well-intentioned politicians.
It's hard to do. It's hard for me to imagine, but I'll do my best. Are we going to try to see The Boys in the Band as well?
And that is the last item on the list. So,
all right.
You know, now that there's no World Series for me to watch.
Yeah, sorry, buddy.
Okay. All right, it's time to check out some more things.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
Heartbreak.
Comes with the territory, right?
I hear you. I know what you mean. I've had my heart broken by the sports as well.
I have a feeling we'll be back to blow it next year, too.
Oh. There's always the future times of blowing it.
I am fully, like, you know, I know you're not a Cubs fan, but you're from Chicago. So, like, you know, that sort of that Cubs-Red Sox mentality I think Dodgers and Mets fans have now, too. Yeah, like it's fully set in for me. Like I've just sort of accepted that this is what baseball is.
Well,
inevitable heartbreak.
You never know, man. There's a lot of talent. Good luck to you. Maybe it'll be a White Sox White Sox Braves World Series next year.
Maybe. Yeah, we need like the Indians again or something like that because you know it's one of those situations where one of these teams can possibly not blow it. You know?
Nah.
Somebody has to not blow it.
No, absolutely not. I veto your Cleveland support.
Because if we play you, you guys don't always blow it, right? Yeah, like you could totally not blow it against us.
Well, we might. I'm just saying it'd be fun. We could have some fun.
All right, sounds good.
All right. Well, we'll save that. I don't even know what baseball is anymore. Forget baseball. It's not even happening.
Did we do a short show? Was this a success?
Short-ish, you know. If we hadn't taken a couple breaks in the middle and recorded a segment we didn't use, it would have been pretty short. So maybe the people will think it's short, right? That's something. Yeah. That's something.
Yeah, we should have tubed the opening minutes for sure.
We should not have done that. Let's be as short as we can now. And I'm going to resist another tubing joke there. Bye!
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.